And we're having a marvelous discussion with astronomer David Darling, and you are part of it. So we'll take your calls this hour with him when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back. David Darling with us. His latest book is called Weird Math. This teenage genius, what will become of him, David? What field is he going to enter? As you said, he's going to Cambridge. Yeah, what's he going to study?
He wants to be a research mathematician, so he's going to be taking his math degree there. And he sees himself doing this as a career, pioneering new areas of math.
Will he be another Einstein type?
Well, he's got the IQ for it. He took the Mensa test, you know, the Association for Smart People, when he was 13, and he got the highest, he scored the highest IQ that they've ever had. It was 162, but that was actually the highest they go, which was higher than Hawking.
Jeez.
Although he's quite modest about that. He says that IQs don't really mean that much, but he's a super smart kid.
What do you think?
He's on the trajectories on at the moment. We're going to hear from him in the future, I'm sure.
What do you think is going on in his brain to create that kind of intelligence? What's happening biologically?
Yeah, I don't know. I've asked him, and he doesn't know either. He's tried to explain it to me. Because if you look at brains, human brains, they're all pretty much the same. They're normal brain.
That's right.
Einstein's brain and your brain, they're going to look pretty much the same from the outside.
Thank you.
So there's nothing in general that's different. But I just wonder if there's some sort of switch that's thrown in his brain that's not thrown in my brain that opens him up to ideas and the speed of calculation that normal people can't do. I just wonder if it's something we're actually all capable of if we knew how to access it.
Well, that's pretty dramatic. Can I quote you, by the way, and said David Darling says that I have an Einstein brain? That we're the same?
Well, okay.
I love it. But back to these parallel universes. This fascinates me because when did this start coming up? It wasn't that long ago, was it?
Well, the parallel universes stuff, it has a history in physics. I mean, I did talk about the fourth dimension as being something that goes back to almost to Victorian times, the idea of a fourth dimension of space. But the idea of there being parallel worlds kind of goes back to the 60s, really, in physics. And it's sort of entered the mainstream consciousness now. And of course, it's been used a lot in science fiction as well, this idea of transfer between worlds. But I think whenever you've got a proper scientific basis for something, then you get more speculation building on top of that. But it does have probably about a 50-year history behind it in terms of the science of it.
Fascinating work. David, how did you get involved in all of this? I bet you when you were a kid, you loved space and science all that, didn't you?
Yeah. I remember when I think I was 5 years old, and my dad, he had this encyclopedia salesman around, because this is before Wikipedia, right, the internet. We had encyclopedias, and this guy must have been talking to my dad for a couple of hours, and in the end, my dad bought a set of 10 of these encyclopedias, and he showed them to me. He said, you know, these are what you can grow, but now you learn from these. And I zeroed in on the astronomy section right away, and the pictures that they're just primitive black and white pictures. They just fired my imagination. I just wanted to know what was out there. So it goes back as far as I can remember, my interest in space. Yeah, a long, long time ago.
My parents bought me a 4-inch retractor telescope.
Cool.
And then I joined a telescope club, and I will always remember taking that telescope out in the winter night in Detroit, Michigan, David.
Uh-huh.
Really cold. I'm all by myself, setting up the telescope to look at the stars and planets, and it's just so exciting, and it's pitch black out, twinkly stars. And the first thing that I spotted and set up, we had a newspaper there called the Detroit News, and they would every day publish planetary positions. So if you had a telescope, you'd go out and find it. And I looked at Saturn, and I could see with this 4-inch refractor telescope the rings. And it just looked like this thing was painted on a black canvas, just hanging out there.
And I
was just so mesmerized by that as a little kid. I mean, I'm looking at the planet. You could see the rings going around it. I've never seen anything like that since, ever in my life.
No, and it leaves such an impression at that age as well, too, doesn't it? But I sometimes go out and look at the night sky and, you know, try and realize what the distances, you know, that there's nothing between me and those suns, other suns, except trillions and trillions of miles of empty space. It is an incredible thought, really.
And then, you know, I set my sights on Jupiter, and you can't see much on Jupiter because it's so bright from the reflection of the sun. But I saw the four moons all around it.
Oh, they're cool, aren't they?
And that was just fantastic.
From hour to hour, almost.
Oh my gosh, it was something else. And then when you look at the moon and you see the craters really up front, you know what? Every kid should have a telescope, I think.
Yeah. Or even a good pair of binoculars for the moon. They're good for the moon as well.
Yep.
But I think so, and it inspires you. That's what really the whole idea, the imagination, then takes off, doesn't it? And you're hooked for life after that.
And the guy who owned the telescope store, who had the telescope club, he took my tripod, which was all wood, and he spray painted it black, and then he dipped a paintbrush in white paint and spackled it like stars.
Oh, cool!
And so you know, once it dried, I had this tripod that just looked like the universe itself.
Cool,
it was
yeah.
really something. Let's take
and
some
calls. Refractor, that's a good-sized telescope.
Yeah, it sure was. Sure was. And, you know, then I started looking at the reflector types, trying to determine, did they get me the right one and all that. Let's go to Bob, truck driving in Iowa, to get things started. Hey, Robert, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hello, George.
Hi there.
My theory is that time is linear. And time is an event. Suppose you could access a dimension that would give you access to nonlinear time. You could travel back through history, or you could travel from universe to universe instantaneously.
What do you think of that, David?
Yeah, well, I think most
lineal time.
Most people think of time as being linear, and if you're going to travel in time, you somehow have to, I guess, loop around, don't you? You've got to loop back, or you've got to move forwards. And I think this whole idea of linear time sometimes locks us into a certain way of thinking of things, and we do have to be more flexible if we're going to talk about, moving to other points in time, either within our own universe and beyond. So he's right. Yeah, linear time is a way we've come to think of it. Other cultures actually think more in terms of cyclical time. You know, time in cycles and circles, and that opens up a whole new possibility about ideas like time travel. So I agree. We overemphasize linear time.
Do you think we'll ever time travel like H.G. Wells' book, The Time Machine? Do you think we'll ever have that capability?
I don't know whether we'll have. I don't think it'll be a simple device like that. That was a sort of very Victorian idea. It is a very, very picturesque idea. I think it's going to take some pretty impressive technology to be able to do it. Super scale technology, because a lot of energy will have to be involved. We could certainly send things into the future now, and in a sense, by putting close to the speed of light. And if we can harness gravity, and we can harness things like wormholes and things like that, we should be able to communicate at least with the past, even if we can't send large objects back. But in the future, who knows? The technology will be so much more advanced than what we've got now. We've got the theoretical understanding of how time travel might work. There's no reason to think that in the far future, maybe not the so far future either, we should be able to move around in time.
You remember the original movie from 1960, The Time Machine?
Yeah.
What a classic.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, it was. It was cool, a cool show, yeah.
Rod Taylor, who played the part of H.G. Wells.
That's right, and the Morlocks. Oh, my gosh.
It was a classic. Love that movie. I was 10 years old when it came out. Let's go to Joe in the Bronx. Welcome to the show. Hey, Joe, go ahead.
Hi, George. How are you?
All right, Joe. Thanks.
Good. I'd like to ask your guest if he believes in interlocking dimensions, and also if he thinks that there could be locations in the universe where time does not exist as an organizational measurement tool.
Interesting take, David.
Okay, well, we were talking about this sort of interdimensional travel, weren't we, and whether it's possible to, if there are these parallel worlds, move between them. We don't know is the simple answer. We certainly don't have the technology. We don't really have the theory of how to do that. We have this idea of using wormholes, that we can access different, if wormholes exist, that you could move to different points in space and time. That assumes, though, that you can control the wormhole. You know, if you had an artificial wormhole, you could set one end where you wanted to go, and it works like kind of a subway system. That's what Carl Sagan, of course, was talking about in Contact, where you have like a cosmic subway system based on wormholes. So in a sense, that is kind of like an interdimensional form of travel. Whether you could do it in some other way, I think, is pure speculation at the moment. And the other question was, are there regions of the universe where time is sort of confused? And I think, yes, that's possibly true. And this gets back to the idea that we have a very simple view of time here on Earth, because everything runs according to clocks and we measure it out linearly. If you've got a situation where particles, and this is the case of the Big Bang, for example, or just after the Big Bang, where you have this incredibly hot particle stew, who says what time is there? How do you determine what the sequence of time is? So anywhere where you've got a confusing amount of matter and energy locally, it would be hard to measure time within that region, I think.
What do you think of the theory that we're all living in some kind of digital world?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? You know, whenever I think of sort of simulated worlds, I always think of the Truman Show.
Yeah.
Remember Tom Hanks? He's born and raised in this what he thinks is the outside world, but it's really a bubble just created by a film studio. And he determines at the end of it, he starts to notice odd things, and he tries to break out and succeeds by crossing this what he thinks is an ocean, but in fact is a big lake, getting to the side and coming to the edge and escaping. Certainly, I mean, we can simulate within computers now pretty good immersive worlds, and this is going to get better and better. So we can, in a sense, already create simple simulated worlds. So if you had a powerful enough computer, why couldn't the entire universe be a simulation? And again, this is a theory that's been kicking around.
It could be. That was Jim Carrey, by the way, not Tom Hanks. That was.
Yeah, of course it was Jim Carrey. Of course it was. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. But it was that sort of thing. So if you live in a simulation, how do you prove that you're in it? That would be quite difficult to do. You'd somehow have to prove there was an edge to it or a graininess to it that was a feature of the computer that produced the simulation. But since your technology itself would be a simulation, it probably wouldn't be as good as the equipment that was producing the simulation. So you might not be able to detect these edge effects. So it's quite possible if you're in a simulation, you might not be able to actually prove it or escape it.
Exactly. Next up, we go to Barry in Rock Hill, South Carolina. Hello, Bear.
Hello there, George. Great talking to you once again.
And thank you,
I got to say hello to Cornelius, of course. I know he's listening.
He's out there. He's not on the line, but he's out there.
Oh, yes, you got it, buddy. I wish we could do something about that pardon for him with the federal charge or whatever, but that's a different subject. Listen, I heard you talking about having your little telescope when you were a kid.
I loved it.
I'll never forget, George. I was 15 years old, and we left Fayetteville, North Carolina on a school bus and drove to Raleigh, North Carolina, which is only about an hour and a half away, and went to the planetarium. And, George, the first time I looked through a telescope, it was a 100-power telescope, and I could see individual particles in the rings of Saturn, and it blew me away.
Oh, it's amazing. It really is.
And what I wanted to get to is, George, I swear I can't believe that every human being on Earth doesn't believe in extraterrestrial beings, because there's been hundreds and even thousands of sightings over Phoenix, dozens of them, Mexico City, China, Russia, Afghanistan, Iran. In other words, it's rampant around the entire world. And, I mean, they're here. The USOs, they say they fly right into the ocean, George, at 200 or 300 miles an hour and don't even make a splash.
Well, we get a lot of those reports. Thanks, Barry. Appreciate that. A lot of people are seeing something, David.
Yep. Yeah, I agree. There's no doubt that UFOs exist in the sense that people see unidentified lights and phenomena. But, you know, the old question is, how do we explain those away? What's the underlying explanation? There are many, many ways that they can be explained, and you obviously know all those things. But is there a residue of sightings when we get beyond all the ones that are frauds and mistaken things like Venus or unusual aircraft? If we get beyond all those, and those are the ones we have to eliminate first, you know, if you're going to be a critical thinker about this, don't jump to the most exotic explanation first, jump to the most mundane, eliminate all those. If in the end there's a residue that you simply can't explain, then you start to think, I mean, something funny is going on here. These seem like artificial, intelligent, controlled craft of some type. I'm open-minded about that. I want to see something that's a little bit firmer than what we have at the moment. I know there's a lot of sightings. Yeah, there is a lot of sightings, but that still in itself is not convincing to me.
David, do astronomers collaborate together worldwide on things?
Oh, yes, absolutely they do. They have to. They have to today because the projects are so big and the equipment is so expensive that it's normal now in science to have international collaborations. The telescope time is just simply too expensive and the problems are so difficult that you need to have teams of people from many different countries working together. And the same is true in particle physics. There you often have teams of hundreds of scientists. So they'll produce a paper and the first page is just a list of all the scientists that have been involved. So it's routine that. Whereas in the past, of course, people would tend to work on their own. Today, everybody collaborates.
Next up, let's go to Annie in Alabama. Annie, go ahead.
Hello, Dr. Darling.
Hi there.
Would you like to tell me everything you know about the latest ways that we could get rid of an asteroid if it was approaching the Earth and it was too large to be safe? Are there some new things besides the laser bees and all those?
Well, you're good about the laser, Annie, because that would nudge it. I'm not sure, David, you want to blow it up because then all the chunks come your way.
Yeah. Of course... The thing is early detection. That's the thing. If the thing's barreling down on you and you've got 5 days notice, there's nothing at all you can do except try to hunker down or evacuate wherever it's going to hit. If you detect it's too late and it's too large, there's nothing you can do about it except try and get out of the way or get out of the way in terms of a different part of the Earth. But we're getting better and better. This is the good news at detecting large asteroids. So it's very unlikely that something the size of, say, the one that put pay to the dinosaurs is just going to come out of the blue or the black and just knock us for six overnight or even with a year's warning. We know about the whereabouts of these big asteroids now, so it's unlikely that a big one would strike. It's the ones that are maybe, you know, a few hundred yards across, and we don't know about all of those yet, that could strike without warning. If we knew in advance that there was a large asteroid approaching, we would have to be very, very careful. We'd have to know exactly what the trajectory was, because if we start trying to move it around, we might make things worse. We might put it on a collision trajectory, whereas before it was just going to miss us. If you've got years and years, then you can, for example, put rocket engines on it, so you can give it a sort of propulsion system and sort of push it out of the way. But that means you've got to have a big lead time. So it really depends on how much time you've got. But the big asteroids, at the moment, I don't think we need to worry about those. It's the medium-sized ones that are the problem.
We're going to come back and take final calls with the astronomer, David Darling, author of Weird Math, next. And welcome back to Coast, our final segment with astronomer David Darling, his latest book, Weird Math. David, where do people get this book?
Anywhere. You can order it online, Amazon, or go into any bookstore, and if they don't have it in stock, they'll be able to get it for you.
Super. It's a neat book. How did you come across the teenage genius again?
Well, by accident, really. I've always done tuitions with students. I've always had a few students doing math and physics, and his dad called me about 4 years ago and said we're really having trouble stretching Agnijo. Is there anything you can do to help? And he brought him around, and I've been working with him ever since. He's just a remarkable kid.
That's fantastic. It really is. And how many books do you have out now? More than 40, right?
I've lost count, really. I've written more. I think somebody said 44 the other day. And many of them, I think a dozen or so, are still in print in various forms.
Teleportation. Is it possible? Can we really beam ourselves? We've had guests on who say they've been teleported to Mars and everything else.
I was going to say yes to your first question, because we could certainly teleport particles, but that's not what people are really interested in. But we can do that. We can teleport light particles and electrons and things like that. So the question is whether you could do it on a large scale or not. It's one of complexity, really.
And in one piece.
Yeah, exactly. You wouldn't want to end up there just a jumble.
That's right. Come back with half of me or something.
Yeah, exactly. Or even if it was a whole you, is it still you? That's the thing. You know, you're made of different atoms. Is it still you or is it a copy? And what happens if the original copy remains and there's two of you? Which one is the real you?
Yeah.
So there's all kinds of issues like that. Whether it's possible or not, I think the future will tell us that.
It'll take machinery, though, to do it, won't it?
Oh, it'll take machinery. Well, yeah, I guess, unless you believe in the psychic teleportation. But if we're talking about technology, it'll involve incredibly complex, sophisticated equipment, which we're nowhere near.
You know, I'm amazed. You could call it almost a form of teleportation, sending pictures through text messaging. I mean, I could in an instant. Yeah. I mean, there you are in the United Kingdom. I could in an instant send you a picture. It flies through the air in the greatest of ease. It's there in an instant.
I know. And another thing that came up the other week I thought was amazing, 3D printers. They've got one on the space station, and they had a part missing, so they sent up the instruction for printing out the part. They printed it right there on the station, and there it was. That's almost like teleporting things, isn't it, by a different way?
That's a good point. Let's go back to the calls now. Let's go to Jimmy in Asheville, North Carolina, where I will be on August 25th. Hey, Jimmy.
Hey, sir.
Good to have you. Go ahead.
Thanks. I was thinking about time, and it mainly shows the beginning and the end, and the life and death. So could it have started in the garden with Adam and Eve when they first sinned?
Could time have started in the Garden of Eden, David?
Okay, well, I'm probably not the right person to ask religious questions of, but I think the issue is still the same. Whatever picture you draw, whether it's a religious picture or a scientific picture, you still have this problem of how can time begin? Because then you have to ask what came before that.
That's right.
Whether you want to frame that in a religious sense, okay, well, was God before that? You still come up against a question mark, and that there is no answer to that. Well, I certainly don't have the answer to it. So whether you want to put it in the Garden of Eden or when you were put it, before the Big Bang, it's the same issue. How can something come from nothing, and how can time start from no time? Because you'd think there had to be a period of preparation where the universe decides to sort of suddenly become something, and if there isn't, I think there's a real philosophical problem there. So I don't think the issue is any different whether we take the sort of traditional, literal biblical view, or we go to the more modern scientific view. The issue is still the same. So I think there's still a question mark there.
It's almost unacceptable to accept the fact that there was nothing before there was something.
I know, and I don't like it when people brush that aside and they start rushing into the sort of stages after that, because for me, that's the one thing that interests me.
That's the key point right there.
The whole point, because, once you get to quarks and all this sort of stuff and you start building particles, it's almost like, just textbook physics in a way. But the initial event, that's where the interest is.
Well, David, is the answer so far away that you can't even speculate, even with all your years of knowledge and experience? Can you guess how it may have started from nothing? You can't. Impossible.
I can't because, I don't think it necessarily has an answer. I don't think it necessarily has an answer. The only answer that I can give is in terms of the multiverse thing, which again just pushes the question back, because where did anything start? Well, okay, the other thing is maybe it's always been there. The universe is infinitely old. It stretches back infinitely far in time. But that again is, you conceptually, that's still, we can't grasp it. It may be true, but we cannot grasp it in our minds.
Let's go next to Keith in St. Louis. Welcome to the show, Keith. You are, no, Keith is not ready yet. So let's go to Mary in New Jersey. Hey, Mary, your turn. Go ahead.
Hello, everybody. Hello. I have a question. Our planet, are we the only ones with rain clouds? And if so, why are we so different?
Are we the only planet with rain clouds? We're the only world within the solar system that has rain clouds, as far as we know. It appears that it rains on other moons like Titan, for example, which has liquid methane on its surface. It rains methane on Titan, but there's no water there, so the conditions are very different. To my knowledge, the Earth is the only world within the solar system that produces rain, because it's the only one that has water vapor, extensive amount of water vapor in its atmosphere. I suppose Venus might also, it rains sulfuric acid actually on Venus, so it is a kind of a mixture of water vapor and sulfuric acid, but that's not, it's a different sort of a chemical situation on Venus. But we're the only ones that genuinely you would have a shower of rain. Now, that, of course, there are many, many worlds out there that we don't know enough about to say whether it rains. We know that there are worlds out there that have water vapor in their atmosphere, so it's quite possible that it does rain on those worlds, but we need to know more about them to be able to say that for sure. Almost certainly, though, that with the number of worlds that are out there, we already know about 3,000 exoplanets. There are millions and millions of them out there waiting to be discovered. There's bound to be rain on many of them, I would think.
I would think so. Rob's in Vancouver in Canada, international line. Hey, Rob, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks very much for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
Maybe this is a naive question, but when it comes to like an asteroid or a disaster-type asteroid coming, you know, to hit the Earth, and maybe it's reminiscent of the old video game Asteroids. But why, you know, you have a thermonuclear warhead goes off. My understanding is there's a fairly large range where material gets vaporized. And with the amount of arsenal that the world has, why couldn't, you know, you launch like 5, 10, 15, even 50 nuclear warheads at an asteroid that is, you know, 5 miles wide? And I'll listen to your answer off the air, I guess. And I don't know if that makes any sense.
Yeah, well, we kind of touched on this a little bit earlier. You certainly could do that, or in the future we would be able to do that. You can fire rockets at things and hit them. We do know how to do that. We don't know what the effects would be. First of all, would an H-bomb of the type that we have be enough to split a 5-mile-wide asteroid? I kind of doubt it myself. I haven't done the physics, but I don't know whether it would actually crack it apart. The other problem, of course, and you mentioned this, George, earlier, is that we then get a whole bunch of fragments, some of which might be pretty large, heading on the same trajectory, because although you might be able to break it up, those particles, those pieces, are still moving in the same trajectory. They're not going to be splattered in all directions. You remember that asteroids are traveling at many miles a second. And just because they blow up doesn't mean that it's going to kind of shower in all directions. All that stuff is still going to be traveling in the same path. So instead of one big thing, you get hit by lots of medium-sized things. And that might be even worse.
Yeah, that could be worse. It could be a disaster of biblical proportions.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like you've said, too, a lot of times, David, these things are spotted after they go past the planet.
Yeah, certainly the medium-sized ones are, but they could still do a lot of damage. One that's 0.5 mile wide, for example, is a city-buster-sized asteroid, and it could devastate the country, really. It wouldn't annihilate all life on Earth, but it could cause a heck of a lot of damage.
Yeah.
Those are the ones we really need to worry about.
The dinosaur killer was six kilometers, right?
Yeah, at least that size. It may have been a little bigger than that. I've heard of estimates about 10 miles across, but it depends on the exact situation, the trajectory and everything, which we don't sure. But it was several miles across, and it's very unlikely that we would be hit by something that large without good notice, because we have very good asteroid tracking systems in place at the moment.
Now let's go to Keith in St. Louis. Hey, Keith, go ahead.
Hey, nice talking to you again.
You too, Keith.
Well, I have kind of several things. You talked about spotting an asteroid farther out, say 5 years out,
mm-hmm.
and putting rockets on it. if you're going to go to that trouble, then you should put it in orbit around the Earth and mine it.
If you can, that's right. If it's got something mineable, that's not a bad idea.
Something mineable on it, or you could put it in orbit and make it a large...
another moon.
Another moon, another base station other than the International Space Station.
Let's get David's thoughts on mining, since you brought that up, Keith. There are valuable assets on some of these asteroids, David.
For sure.
But I don't know if do we have the equipment to remotely mine them and then get them back?
We don't have it at the moment. It's not so far-fetched. Of course, there are companies looking into this possibility because the commercial rewards would be tremendous. The technology is certainly feasible. It's large scale, but we know how to fire rockets. We know how to land equipment on things. We just have to scale it up. It's difficult, but not impossible. The idea of putting something into orbit around the Earth is more difficult because these are big things, and you would need a heck of a propulsion system to put something into orbit. Not saying it can't be done, but it would have to be done over a large period of time because the thrust that you could apply to it would be quite small in comparison to its mass. So you'd have to nudge it probably over a period of years, I would think, to get it into orbit. But yeah, ideally that would work. I suppose we already have a big asteroid. We call it the moon, but going around it, that is only a quarter of a million miles away. We could mine that as well. That might be easier than capturing an asteroid and putting it into a smaller orbit. I don't know, and the physics on that. But asteroid mining is as our resources run out is an obvious solution.
Let's go to Ray, truck driving in Oklahoma, first time caller. Ray, go ahead.
Thank you for having me on your show. It's a
sure
pleasure.
Thing, Ray. Thank you.
Question for your guest. Since everything is energy and energy vibrates at specific frequencies and humanity is only able to experience a certain window of that frequency, what is your opinion that dimensions could possibly be frequency-based?
That's a very broad question. I question, first of all, when you said all energy has a certain frequency, I'm not quite sure what that means.
Quantum physics says that it's both a wave and a particle, and it takes conscious observation to knock it into one or the other, which suggests that it could be pure energy in its base form. As we get smaller and smaller and smaller, all particles seem to just keep getting smaller. So that's where I base my idea that everything is energy, and energy vibrates at frequencies. And since we can only see certain frequencies, then outside of those frequencies, we can't observe.
Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, obviously, there are things beyond our senses. You're just talking about the electromagnetic spectrum. We can only see a very narrow window of that. We can only see visible light. We can't see an infrared or X-rays or radio waves. So we know even in that spectrum there are things that we can't see. There are obviously other things we can't perceive as well, like gravitational waves. Our senses are very, very limited because we've evolved to just be able to sense what's useful to us for survival. So there are many things we can't detect, but I think it's a big leap to go from there. First of all, it is quite a nebulous thing to say that all energy has frequency. It's not a very specific thing. And then to go beyond that and say, does that have something to do with, being able to see other dimensions or move back and forth, is highly speculative. I'm not saying that there's nothing valid in it, but I can't quite grasp what the science behind it would be.
That's true. David, I want to thank you for being on the program again. We had 3 years go by since you were last on with me. That's way too long, my friend, okay?
It's been a pleasure. Thanks a lot, George.
Okay. David Darling, the name of his latest book is called Weird Math, and his website is linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com, and he's quite an astronomer, to be sure. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burleson, George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition of Till Then, Be Safe, Everyone.